Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you live a more positively minded life. I ran into something recently that I thought would be valuable to you. And so today we're going to be talking about something about when you have a relationship that becomes so difficult, so tough, that you just don't know what to do. And for many people, they feel just like this. I ran into this very short Percy Mayfield part. I thought I'd like you to hear this.
Don't come back no more.
No more, no more, no more.
Hit the road, Jack. Don't come back no more.
Now what'd you say?
Hit the road, Jack. Don't come back no more.
No more, no more, no more.
Hit the road, Jack. Don't come back no more.
Oh, woman, oh, woman, you sure is mean. You the meanest old woman that I ever seen. But I guess if you said so, bop, bop, I better pack my things and go.
That's right.
Hit the road, Jack, and don't come back no more.
No more, no more, no more.
Hit the road, Jack,
and don't come back no more. How many times have you wanted to say that to somebody, huh? How many times have you wanted to say that, and when you say it to somebody, they'll just plead back at you, oh, baby, you're the meanest old thing I've ever seen. Well, I've called into the program today one of the specialists on dealing with people who say, baby, oh baby, you're the meanest person I've ever seen. And that is, into the program today we have Wendy Bahara. Wendy Bahara, welcome to WBAI, Wendy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Armand.
Wendy is author of Disarming the Narcissist. And it is a book that comes with a series of books about how people have to deal with the narcissistic personality as it manifests in parents, in children, in parents, and in lovers, in husbands and wives. And it's tough. It's tough to be with a narcissist. By the end of the show today, I want you to be able to hear the description of what a narcissist is. I want you to be able to identify it, and by today, be able to learn how to deal with it differently. Because hit the road, Jack, is one of the solutions, but every time you hit that solution, you wind up picking up another one right down the road. So today, we want to talk about really dealing with the narcissistic personality in both men and in women. Wendy, give us a little help. What is a narcissist?
Well, a narcissist shows up in many different ways. Sometimes it's that person who is just incredibly obnoxious and self-centered and arrogant and can't stop talking about themselves and has to be right about everything, feels the rules apply to everyone else but not to them, makes up their own rules, can be very critical and condescending, self-absorbed. It gives you the feeling that their presence in the room is the only presence in the room. And sometimes as you try to wedge a word in, make a request, add an opinion, share a desire, they vanish, or you vanish. You feel invisible in their presence.
That's the kind of a person, that's pretty extreme, because that's the kind of person you might run into at work or something like that, but you wouldn't be living with someone like that.
No, you might be.
I mean, might be, yes, but you'd have to be pretty much down the pike to choose somebody like that, because you disappear completely in their presence.
Yes.
But it's somebody who, at their worst, now you're saying, is so much in their own whirlwind that you almost don't exist.
That's right. That's okay. Right. And there are particular people who, in choosing these types, it doesn't feel so unfamiliar to them. They may have had parents like this. They may have had siblings like this in their lives or other relatives that made an impression on them. So it's not so unfamiliar. They've learned how to disappear. They've learned how to put their needs on hold. They've learned how to become self-sacrificing or to be subjugated. And so, you know, it's almost the perils of therapy, I'll say, that when they come in to look at this, that they begin to discover their own voice, their more healthy side of themselves, and realize that the partner they selected is really consistent with a life theme, a life pattern that they've known for a long time.
So what we're saying here is that if you are related to a narcissist, if you've chosen a narcissist, there may be a good side to it. Let's say you have a personality that you hate. Let's say you hate yourself. Let's say you can't stand your evil ways. Let's say you just think you're a bad kid or a broken kid or you can never love your mother right. Then what you do is you go get yourself a narcissist and you make your personality disappear, subjugate it to his or hers. Right? And so it's not only are you the victim, but you're also maybe willful in making this choice, because if you make this choice, you get buried until the time comes.
Yes.
When you don't feel like being buried anymore. Now the deal is different.
Yes.
Now you've chosen this narcissistic, egocentric, self-centered person, and you've said, oh, look, I've grown up a little. Thanks for whatever you had to do with me feeling a little stronger. Now I don't like the way you are anymore.
That's right.
Now that becomes a problem.
Absolutely. It's the problem in therapy. It becomes somewhat disjointed. And I really think it's the responsibility, if this person has sought counseling, for the therapist to pay attention to...
Which person are you talking about?
The victim.
Is there a victim here?
Well, in the case of the person who's feeling like a victim, I call them the virtuous victims, the one who feel no responsibility in the selection of a narcissistic partner or no responsibility in staying in relationships. And many of them want to be in those relationships. But going back to your point in that maybe, choosing this person allows them to feel
that they have
a sense of self.
Let's do something. For this discussion, when you talk about the narcissist, let's refer to that as the narcissist. When we talk about the other, we'll talk about the other.
Okay.
Because if we just say they or them, we may get confused.
Sure.
But let's go back a second. There are many different kinds of narcissism. We started off with one, which is the extreme.
Yes.
Tell me about a female narcissist. What is that like? What's a woman like in a narcissist, and how might that be different than a man?
The emphasis is different. Women narcissists tend to, more of the emphasis is placed on their appearance, so there's more issues. There's overlap in all of these, but with women we see a greater emphasis on issues of vanity, issues of domestic success, meaning how well their children are doing, how well they're taking care of their homes, managing their families. So there's a lot more of the needle of the compass gets pointed towards how they're doing in terms of their domestic capacities, the way they look, the way they show up, the friends that they cling to or belong to, the organizations that they dominate, or the leadership roles that they've taken within those organizations. So there's different flavor.
It would seem that a narcissism is bred in adolescence, the seeds for it, and that among boys, it may be a little more difficult to get out of that narcissistic place without having to get to your adulthood. But with young girls, the narcissism is fed in the teenage years. You know, who's going to be in the best club and who the it girls. And like the narcissistic female seems to be a more adolescent phase. It would seem. Now, when a narcissistic woman... She grows up, she becomes dominant, she becomes strong. What does she become? What's she like?
When she becomes an adult?
Yeah. If you're a narcissistic adult woman, are you controlling your mate? What are you doing? What are you like? What are your characteristics?
They're not that dissimilar from the narcissistic male. There's issues of control, being very controlling of partners, controlling of your subordinates, perhaps, in the workplace. Being very focused on your own personal reputation, so whatever missions you may be involved in, the real focus is on how well you're looking, how well you're showing up, how well the people around you are making you look. So there's really less attention being paid to those people in your life. They're only there really as props for your own self-image. I sometimes refer to it as, everyone's holding the spotlight so that she can bask in the glow of that spotlight that's being held upon her. And yes, I think that's an excellent point. In adolescence, it's probably more of a prime time for the development, the emergence of this possibility of narcissism for young girls, whereas I think for boys it may start even earlier.
And could you give me a list of the characteristics of a narcissist that people could think of so that when they're thinking about whether or not their mate or the person that they're in love with or the person who breaks their heart is a narcissist, what would they be? Give me some of the qualities.
Sure. Self-absorbed, meaning that they act like everything is all about them.
Now that's a relative term.
Mm.
Self-absorbed, because they could be self-absorbed, but it's not everything is about them.
That's right.
I mean, that's an exaggeration.
We have to think about these as exaggerated terms.
Okay,
because we can all be self-absorbed at times, it doesn't mean we're
right.
Narcissistic.
So the narcissist is somewhat to extremely self-absorbed.
Yes, think of them as excessive traits, not traits that just happen occasionally or randomly. So entitled, makes the rules, breaks the rules. Again, excessively, that it's more of a
kind of unusual
being.
Guile who walked by a door and say, let's see if I could open this door, as opposed to respecting boundaries, or the person who might feel if a woman is online and she's waiting online.
That's right.
And she feels irate because she's online waiting for her table, or the person who at a restaurant you hear screaming because she's been waiting 20 minutes to get her table.
Yes.
Right? That says to you, Wendy, it says, narcissist over there, you know, the big N letter.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it raises the red flag. And actually had a case like that where one of my clients said to me, it really hit me. I went to the restaurant. I was waiting for my family. They hadn't all arrived. The policy was no one gets seated until everyone has arrived. And I started demanding that I get my table because I saw the tables filling and I knew my wife was arriving shortly. And the manager looked at me and said, hey, buddy, what, the rules don't apply to you? He said, and there it was. It hit me. So again,
what hit him?
What we'd have talked about already in therapy.
The entitlement.
This excessive sense of entitlement.
This sense of entitlement is a beautiful thing that you talk about, Wendy, because entitlement is like it's a funny thing. It runs across so many psychiatric syndromes. And it's almost like a childlike condition.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like I'm a baby and I have a right to be fed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's such an... When you see entitlement in... or sense of entitlement in movie stars or in people who are the hoi polloi, you know, it's like a part of me saying... It's almost like infancy. It's almost like you're a baby who feels like if you demand the breast, you've got to have it.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And it's there. I mean, so many people have this.
Yes.
And entitled is not, I am entitled to live free. I am entitled to have, you know, a home and a shelter. Entitled is, I am entitled to privilege.
Yes.
Right? So the kind of entitlement we talk about when we talk about narcissism is we talk about a kind of a privilege that a person has.
Right.
Just entitled.
It's
sense
of feeling special. I'm special. Therefore, I'm entitled to those privileges. And that can come by way of having witnessed that. You know, you grow up in a family where that's what's being modeled for you. Our parents who break the rules and act special and extraordinary and have those privileges. Or it's someone who's just trying to cover up what might really feel underneath, like they have no privileges. And so it's a sort of fighting the system.
Well, we're going to have to get to that cover-up in a little bit. We're talking with Wendy Bahary, Behary, who wrote the book Disarming the Narcissist, which is about surviving and thriving with the self-absorbed, you know? Okay, we're talking about symptoms now, or the primary recognizing narcissist. You said being self-absorbed is one, clearly.
Yes.
Having this entitled sense of privilege is another. What's another?
Being demeaning. Another classic sign is this, one-upmanship. And that means that in order for the narcissist to feel good about themselves, they have to put you down. So they can literally become like bullies. And become condescending and hypercritical. And again, this is an excessive form.
Well, it could also come in the form of inference, you know. Even like you show somebody who works for you how to do a simple task, and you add a little tisk at the end of it, you know, like you should have known
exactly
how to do it. Or you teach somebody how they should use the remote to run the TV. Give me that remote, I'll run it. Right, because you're better at the remote than the other person is. That little bit of stuff that has a little edge to it.
Yes.
And it's hard to know that edge unless you're on the other side of it. If you're somebody who feels that somebody, you know, that you're not being loved and you need a little something, every time you get that edge, it feels like a little razor cut.
That's right.
And it's the razor cut that tells you that this is happening more than necessarily the behavior. Now, the behavior could be extreme. They could really demean you. You stupid, you rotten, you're no good. But the razor cut, you know, it's almost like a paper cut, is so wicked, and it counts just as much.
That's why one client calls it death by a thousand cuts.
Beautiful.
Right. Really, it's the facial expressions, it's the smug tone of voice, it's raising the eyebrows, which looks like you're such an idiot, or how come you don't understand this, and... So you're right. It can be sometimes just the small sting.
So, you know, one of the associated connections here with the word demeaning would be sarcasm.
Yes, and cynicism.
Sarcasm and cynicism are both symptoms of narcissism.
Yes,
Interesting.
That's right.
Next.
Demanding, which is similar to entitled. Demanding whatever they want when they want it, even if it's unrealistic. And that happens, we see that frequently in the workplace, where, you know, someone who's working for a narcissist will feel that, and rightly so, that the requests are just unrealistic, the time limits are unrealistic. And I'm not talking about economical issues where you're understaffed and you're working on tight schedules. I'm talking about someone who is just so out of touch with the impact of what they're asking for. They're so demanding and feel so entitled that they're just layering it on. And the other, who's the person working for the narcissist, is overwhelmed by this demanding nature.
In a relationship, there is, if you're in a relationship and there's a narcissist with a, we'll call it a narcissistic other, or the other side of the narcissist, because I don't think victim is the right word. Mm. But if you have the counterpart to the narcissist, it's kind of a deal, you know. I demand you get, I demand you get, I demand you get, until you stop getting. Now, when you stop getting and say, no, I don't want to get, then what happens to the narcissist?
When the other refuses to meet the demands?
To meet the demand, sure. They unravel.
It depends. It depends on how it's said. I mean, it can lead to escalations of conflict, certainly in the relationship, if you just decide, I'm not going to give that to you. It depends on how it's communicated.
All right. So, but the point of it is that the demanding, we're talking about symptoms of a narcissist, and that demanding takes two sides to it. In order to demand, you have to have somebody who's responding.
That's right.
If you don't have the response, you can demand all you want.
That's right.
It's like being a king. It's great to be king, but if you're king of an empty place, you're king of nothing.
Exactly.
You know?
That's true of the narcissist.
Ralph Crandom. You remember Ralph Crandom? Remember he did that once? He said, I'm the king and you're nothing, he said to... Jane, and she turned around to him and said, that means you're the king of nothing.
That's right.
Okay, so
no, they're allowed to be narcissistic because there are no consequences.
Sure.
So without consequences, they can continue to demand.
That was a pretty interesting, Ralph Cramden was a pretty interesting characteristic, you know, of that narcissistic personality, the way he performed himself, you know, showing all that vulnerability too, and the soft side too, but it was like, it was there, and how did she live with him, how did Jane Meadows live with him, you know, it was very interesting, and we'll learn from them as well, the way she handled him. We should, you call that the Jane Meadows school of handling narcissists. Because she handled them beautifully.
She did. She set limits.
She absolutely set limits and didn't throw them away. Because, you know, you don't always want to throw away your narcissist.
Most of my clients don't want to throw them away.
Right.
In fact, they're there feeling that, is there something wrong with me? Because I love him in spite of this. I still love him. I still see the tender side of him. I see the tender part of him as a human, the caring side, the sweet side. And so I don't want to leave him. Is there something wrong with me? And so they, you know, they're there really trying to figure out how they can reach into the best parts.
Whether it's a him or a her, and I know you
or
always
her.
Put it. There is something about the narcissistic personality that is so powerful. It's so amazing because it's so filled with energy.
Yes.
And, you know, you rarely have a disenergized narcissist. I mean, I'm sure you do. I'm sure there's some forms of depression that harvests a narcissist as well. But mainly you've got somebody who's filled with energy and power. And if you're a depressed person, being related to a narcissist helps you out of your depression. The narcissist becomes the fire for your stone. You know, you become like a stone. You can't be moved. So I've known many men who are depressed, and they elect to be with women who are unavailable. And usually the unavailable ones are the narcissistic ones. And they strive towards, and in that striving, what they look for is they're always looking to kind of get to have a reason to put their energy out so that they get out of their depression. They're now pushing their energy out to win the love of another person.
Hmm.
So being related to a narcissist is a way of curing your own depression. Not curing it necessarily, but alleviating your own depression.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of looking at it. The other side is sometimes seeing them becoming depressed as a result of feeling so oppressed.
Do you think that that's the way it works? Do you think that that's happening? Do you think a normal person walks in, marries a narcissist, and then gets depressed? Or do you think a depressed person walks in, marries a narcissist, and then...
I think someone who has tendencies, you know, to become depressed, or someone who has tendencies to become so invisible, might marry a narcissist and become more depressed as a result.
I can tell you, you know, there must be narcissists out there who are so grateful that they have found people who could tolerate them, who could deal with them, who could love them through it, and that if the narcissist who finds even therapy help through you or through self-confrontation asks themselves the question, what's more important to me? Is it more important that I stay separate, which I do in my narcissistic world, I'm all alone? Or do I want to feel like I belong to somebody?
Mm-hmm.
If you're lucky enough to have an insightful mate, a mate who looks at herself or himself as well, somebody who will grow with you, the two of you grow together, and the relationship could be really fabulous. So hit the road, Jack, is not the only other solution. It's not the only solution.
That's correct.
You know, hit the book, Jack, may be good, too.
You're actually raising a really good point, too. And in my practice, what I see is, interestingly, there's a high correlation between the narcissistic people who do really well and are able to begin to heal and those being married to or involved with partners who are very loving, who have taken the time to do what you just described, look inside themselves, understand themselves in the context of this relationship and otherwise, and they continue to love them well, the narcissist. And there's an interesting correlation between the way they heal, the way they improve.
Who's
in
their
overall, the narcissist themselves, in the way they're able to shed, you know, some of those arrogant and difficult, obnoxious behaviors.
We haven't completed the recognizing the narcissist,
yes.
But well, before we do, you're saying something I think that is really interesting, that, you know, when you see a narcissist, a person who is in that narcissistic spin, part of what you don't understand is how they have decided that alone is the best place to be, even though they're with you. So they are not lonely, but they have just decided alone is the only way to go. The only one I trust is me. And so what happens is you're looking at somebody who has decided, I am never going to be really loved. See?
Exactly.
Now that is, if you saw it that way when you met someone, like if you looked at somebody on stage, if you looked at Madonna and you determined that's who I was looking at, not that I would diagnose her, but if you looked at somebody like Madonna and you said to yourself, you know, there's a classic example of a narcissist, and look at what this poor person is saying. This young girl is saying, I can never be loved. And if you look at her life, you see that kind of manifests, as many of the movie stars with their relationships kind of show. I can never really be touched, so I'm going to be touched only by myself as I spin it in my own world, and I'm going to command the people who will touch me and love me, mm-hmm. and then they will be around me as I so choose, but nobody's going to really love me. And when you find a mate who actually steps up to the plate and understands that about you, and slowly, with loving hands, begins to kind of say to you, it's all right, let me in, let me in, let me in, I'm here. and has the power to go through all of your mishigas. Hmm. It's kind of amazing. How lucky for them. Symptoms of, we have 4 minutes. Let me just, we have more time, but we're going to take a short break. What other things besides the, we so far talked about self-absorbed, entitled, demeaning, demanding, what else?
Distrustful, suspicious of motives when you're being nice to them. And that goes to the core of what you just said, Armand, which is if you're carrying around the belief that no one can really care about me, no one can really love me, no one can really get me or meet my needs, and suddenly someone is acting nice to you or someone wants to do something for you, it can arouse an immediate suspicion that they're up to something, you know, that they couldn't really mean that because I'm supposed to be alone. No one is supposed to really get me. So there's a lot of distrust that also occurs, which makes it difficult for people who are trying, for partners who are trying to love the narcissist at times, when the narcissist cannot be receptive to that love.
I'm going to tell you a brief story about a man I knew who was kind of a star. He was a lecturer and a leader, and then one day he got picked up by his friends on his birthday and taken up to a special hotel, I think it was Mohonk or something, but he was blindfolded the whole way in a limousine, and they get him up there, and they get him into this incredible room, but he's blindfolded, and people are taking care of him. Now, mind you, narcissistic leader just ran a big workshop with a whole bunch of people in a car going up to Mohonk, doesn't know what's going on, is not controlling it, trying to let it go with the flow, you know, trying to. Gets up there and he's sitting down, and somewhere it happens that he's laying on a floor and he's got these six friends around him, and the friends just simply say to him, I love you, one at a time. And it's his challenge to himself, because he was kind of a self-warrior, and he realized something. He said, if I let in those words, I love you, it will break my chest open. My heart will part as if you put a saw right through it, and I will feel pain beyond all pain that I've ever felt. He said, and he realized laying there that as the people were saying this to him, and he's going through this experiment, just, I love you, and they would say his name, I love you. And he would feel, because they really did, as he tried to feel it, he felt concomitantly this excruciating pain of what it would be like to let somebody in.
Yes.
And lucky for him, his friends and he were able to do it that day, and he said it wound up into just a mountain of tears. That was all the pain. But it took major work, and it took a lot of good friends, and it took some special stuff.
Sure.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We are talking with Wendy Bahari, author of Disarming the Narcissist. We're going to continue talking about the narcissistic personality. We've talked about so far five of the characteristics: the self-absorbed, the entitled, the demeaning, the demanding, and the distrustful. You know, the suspiciousness, just finally, it makes so much sense. If you're going to be alone, and if you're convinced that the only way on the planet is to be alone and control it, you got to watch your doors. You got to make sure nobody's coming in. You can't let anybody in the soft way.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's
so
right.
Distrust is part of it. It doesn't have to be paranoia, but just a basic distrust. And the last one that we'll touch with is this one you call snobbishness. I'm kind of interested in that. How do you see snobbishness?
Well, I see it as this feeling that they are superior. They get very bored with people. And common phrases I'll hear are, you know, people bore me. I hate small talk. Most people aren't very bright. Most people aren't very interesting. You know, I'm of superior intelligence. So that's the kind of snobbishness I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm. I hear, and this is Armand DeMille with you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we are going to play a little music. How about a little more Hit the Road, Jack? And then we'll continue our program.
Talking to me, baby. You're not talking to me. Who better can stay, baby?
Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more.
come back no more. You know, and it's where is Hit the Road Jane?
It's Alice. That's her name on the show, Alice.
Alice who? Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, of course, Alice is Alice Cramden, right? No, Hit the Road Jane is the song that's missing because we have Hit the Road Jack, as if the only narcissists that ever exist are men. You know, and there's a lot of guys out there who are related to, a lot of people who are related to narcissistic women, especially nowadays when industry has made more room for the bosses to be women in the workplace. And when the women get in the workplace, it's almost like a defensive position you see very often when they become narcissistic and obnoxious. Mm-hmm. Not that women do that, but the ones that do seem to do it with an arrogance that bespeaks, you know, I must be this way because it's the only way I can get through. Right. So it invites the narcissistic woman into that world, and they are so offensive, especially to other women.
Yes.
Men will respond to them because sometimes men like being subjugated. But women in general will not respond well to an arrogant, narcissistic boss. Mm. I think. What do you think, Alice? Alice. Right? What do you think, Wendy?
I think they would. You think women will not respond to a narcissistic boss?
I think they will respond negatively. But I think that it's, I mean, I think the kind of negativity that takes place at a workplace between women hating their women bosses is much bigger than women hating their men bosses. And I think women hating their women bosses means that the women bosses are being arrogant and doing all of these things that we're talking about and being entitled and demeaning and demanding.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think it's much more difficult to deal with it when it comes from women.
Well, it's uncharacteristic for women to be that way to begin with in the workplace.
And I think if you're a person in the workplace, you're looking for your superior to be maternal. You're looking for her to be nurturing.
Yes.
And if you don't find nurturing, boy, you get the opposite of nurturing, which is not being paternal. It's being witchy.
And women working in the workplace are trained to be, I mean, women are trained, period, to be more self-sacrificing, more subservient, more passive, more submissive. And so they don't necessarily fight back. They do what they're told to do.
So let's continue with the symptoms of, or the signs of, what a narcissist is. You continue. Okay, we've talked so far about the self-absorbed, the entitled, the demanding, the demeaning, the distrustful person. Now, we did not talk about perfectionists.
The perfectionistic trait, again, excessive perfectionism, which is what I also call an unrelenting standard, meaning that nothing is ever good enough. It can always be better. There's a lot of sacrifice of pleasure and family and friends and social interactions for the sake of being able to do things perfectly. So you end up with workaholism for the sake of success. And always striving for more. So, again, it goes back to something you said earlier, even in that description of that story. If you believe you're not going to get your needs met, and by the same token, when someone tries to love you, it's met with this almost intolerable or excruciating feeling of pain. So there's a delight in getting that attention in a loving way, but there's also wanting to push it away because it feels uncomfortable. They don't want those longings to be opened up for fear that they're going to be disappointed again or devastated.
Let's go back to the pronouns here. The they is
the narcissist. I'm describing just right. The narcissist now.
Well, you're also talking about the people who are related to them. You're talking about the people who are loving them.
The people who are loving them, that's right.
So the counterpart to the narcissist, when loving the narcissist, very often will give the kind of love to that person which is just too painful for them to let in.
Yes.
And the other signs, we have the perfectionism. What other signs do we have?
Approval seeking, craving that attention, always looking for the audience that can let them know that they are great and wonderful and extraordinary people. So there's a real focus on what other people think about me.
Now, there seems to be two levels of that I've seen. A person who is quietly looking for approval and another person who's overtly demanding it. Both in the narcissistic realm. There are some people who are too proud to even ask for it. And, you know, they just kind of demand it but they don't ask for it. And then there's the other level, which you're talking about, which is demanding.
Yeah, I'm talking about the more bombastic type that step up and brag and boast and, you know, really trying to get other people to experience a sense of envy or want to be in their presence. So it's very status-seeking, too. There is that type. The unempathic is another trait of the narcissist. Uninterested in understanding your experience or seemingly unable to do so. That they can't walk in your shoes. They can't feel what you're feeling on the inside. They can't necessarily appreciate the impact of their behaviors on you, meaning the counterpart of the narcissist when I say you. Now, I don't believe that the narcissist is incapable of empathy. I think they just have an unrealized capacity for empathy. I do think that with help, with someone helping, modeling, getting them, being able to demonstrate that they can understand the narcissist's needs, I think narcissists can also in turn learn how to dig deep and find that part of themselves that can actually feel the inner world of another.
Well, what do they need? I mean, and how do you advise them in therapy? How do you work with them? Now, is it working with a narcissist or working with a narcissistic couple? Because very often the narcissist will not come into treatment.
The narcissist will only come into treatment, you're right, if there is some leverage. That means that a partner has threatened to leave them. So it's get help or go away. I'm leaving.
And so then they say, wait a minute, this person is valuable to me. I'm going to see what this is. So they come to you skeptically and saying, okay, I'm here to get help because my girlfriend doesn't like me the way I am.
Well, I'm here not necessarily to get help. I'm just here because she wants me to be here. She feels I have a problem. And oftentimes it starts with their complaints about their partner, not necessarily taking responsibility for their own behavior. So it's a little bit of time before we can even begin to get them to own their own behaviors in the relationship and see the narcissist.
And then what happens? How do you get there? I mean, what are you looking for? Are you looking for the underbelly?
Yeah, I'm looking for the underbelly. I'm looking for the part of them underneath that doesn't feel that anyone can truly care about them, that feels a sense of shame or discomfort with their own personal longings for that level of human connection, so much so that they don't allow themselves to feel it. So they walk around in the world looking for approval and attention, working hard to be successful and perfect people, and all in an effort to not feel the pain that lies beneath. And so it's to try to get to that painful, really tender and precious part of them that's underneath all of this veneer, all of these masks that they wear on the outside. And once you do, if you can show caring in therapy, it's almost like becoming a parent. It's really becoming a surrogate parent and really loving that part of them and caring about that part of them, teaching them how to do the same for themselves, enables them to begin to give up some of those soothing, detached, arrogant behaviors and pay more attention to the real human side of the partners in their lives and the others in their lives. So that's how we do it. But it's not it's confrontation of both setting limits on behaviors, but setting limits while offering an understanding for why they do what they do.
Wendy Bahari, author of Disarming the Narcissist. So, Wendy, there are two people you'll treat. You'll treat the narcissist and the narcissistic counterpart.
Yes.
And that you either treat them together or separately. The narcissistic counterpart comes to you and says, look, I love him, but he is driving me crazy. And you don't say dump the bum. You say, here's some things we could do. What are the things you could do?
Well, I coach the counterpart to do, not necessarily to be a therapist, but really how to utilize what I call empathic confrontation, how to begin to understand what lies beneath this narcissistic partner that she or he loves. And so it's really helping them to develop a sense of empathy.
Can you describe how it's done specifically?
Well, a lot of it is understanding the story of the narcissist that they've chosen. Frequently, the partner knows enough about the story of their narcissistic other. And in knowing that story, I can help them to zoom in on the more vulnerable part of the narcissist. You know, see that vulnerability underneath and understand why they have to wear the masks that they choose to wear, which make them so unbearable in the relationship. And it's it's really trying to get them to hone their own sense of empathy so they can begin to understand. That's not to let the narcissist off the hook with excuses. It's really to begin to cobble together a story that makes sense, connect the dots, and then help the partner with that story in mind set limits, but not set limits by attacking him and calling him names and becoming, you know, a new counterattacking partner, but confronting the narcissist with an understanding and a gentle but firm setting of limits. Wendy, like, that hurts me when you do that. I don't think you mean to hurt me when you say those words to me, but it is very hurtful to me. And, or I don't think, I know that your job is important to you, and I know that you don't mean to be late when you promise to be home on time, but it's so disappointing to me. And it's not acceptable when it continues to happen over and over again. So there's a setting of limits with an understanding that the motivation may not be sadistic or evil.
And so by setting the limits, you have to be able to, when you say understanding the person, if you look at eventually every woman who looks at her man or every man who looks at his, whoever picks a star,
yeah.
If you pick a big star to be related to, eventually they're going to fall off their pedestal.
Yes.
And when they fall off their pedestal, remind yourself that it is not really falling off the pedestal, but it's removing the pedestal so that this figure can come down to earth.
Mm.
And it's like if you're so disappointed in the loss of your image, which you may be, you may say, oh, I thought he was such a hero. And he turns out not to be such a hero, but he's got these weak spots. If you're someone who, in your own world, doesn't want a real relationship, that's when you're going to junk him.
That's right.
When you're going to throw them away. But if you're somebody who wants a real relationship with someone where you have investment of love and time, this is the way Wendy and the way Wendy works and the system that she uses, she describes in Disarming the Narcissist, may be of help. Recognizing the underbelly, seeing the underbelly, seeing the bombastic person as being somewhat in pain at the moment, and addressing them with your limits. Such as, I know you don't mean to hurt me, but the way you were talking to me earlier was very offensive. Did you notice that? Did you notice the way I was responding? Like that kind of thing?
Yes, exactly.
Now, what else do you need to do? Because you also talk about reinforcement.
Well, reinforcement because, in fact, they won't necessarily just say, gee, I'm sorry. When you've said that.
No, that's when you call your cousin Louie to come over. That's right. Get the reinforcements.
That's right. Reinforcement means that you really have to take a very persistent position. And in your persistent position, that doesn't mean to begin, you know, escalating into places of anger. Persistently caring about what's underneath, knowing that even as he responds by saying, you're just so damn sensitive, you're just too sensitive, that's why you felt offended by what I said. And being able to say, listen, I'm the one who loves you. I'm the one who cares about you. So, and I get you. And I can say this to you because I care about you and I care about me. Other people out there in the world who don't understand you will just be put off by you. So it's really, I coach counterparts how to be persistent. You know, how to model the same things that they would witness if they were sitting in treatment with their narcissistic partner in a therapy session.
In the positive reinforcement, too, on the other level.
Yes.
Now, let's say the guy does something good.
Oh. Yeah.
Like has a feeling.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's taking less attention, taking the attention away from extraordinary behaviors, like achievement, success, the perfect suit, the perfect attaché case, and putting more attention on those simple niceties. Gee, that was really sweet of you, you know, the way you remembered to call me this afternoon after I went to the doctor to see how my appointment went. I really appreciated that. That was nice of you. So it's reinforcing positive behaviors in the realm of the ordinary, which the narcissist is not accustomed to, because in their world, it's a very black and white scenario. I'm either super special great or I'm nothing. And so it's really helping them find the mid-road where they can feel good about
being. Well, that's kind of beautiful and very important what you're saying. You're saying to that one of the ways through is not to celebrate the big achievements. They don't mean much, or the big presents, or the big gifts, or the big efforts. Those are nice. But to find the one that he may not notice is significant. He or she may not notice is significant. And to say this is special to me, and the very fact that you made dinner or had a salad waiting for me was really, I appreciate it.
Yes.
And to be able to say things like that.
Yes.
Very good, very good. You know, just to finish the list of other signs of a narcissist are?
Unremorseful. Spend some time teaching them how to apologize. I call it the compassion for the wounded versus redemption of the sinner. Frequently,
What do you mean? Could you talk
when
that?
The narcissist, does something that's offensive, and let's say the counterpart says that hurt my feelings, the narcissist might say, "I know, I'm a loser, I'm a jerk, I'm a bad guy, I'm sorry, please forgive me. Do we have to make a big deal about this?" They are desperately trying to get off the hook. They don't want to feel like the bad guy. Teaching them how to be remorseful means focusing again empathically on the impact of their behavior on the other. So counterparts can learn, or if the narcissist is in therapy, we teach them how to artfully apologize, which means compassion for the person you've hurt. Gee, I know that when I raise my voice like that, it's really painful to you. You have a lot of trouble with anger. It's really upsetting. It's always been an issue for you. So I know it's scary for you when I get upset and I raise my voice the way I do. And I apologize for that because I don't want to hurt you. It's a different level of apology than, I know I'm a jerk and I'm a bad guy. Please let me off the hook and forgive me. So we focus on really trying to help them appreciate what's happening to the other. Compulsive, getting overly consumed with details and minutiae might be another trait of the narcissist. Addictive also kind of goes hand in hand with that.
When they get into their compulsive things, you know, and I think something someone once taught me was that under stress, a narcissist will always organize. You see, so if there's a stressor around and the narcissist feels the stress, it could be internal, it could be drinking too much coffee, could be taking steroids, or it could be just something from the outside. He's going to tend to try to organize, and in that organization comes compulsivity, such as, you didn't straighten the house, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. when you see a person going there with the kind of energy that represents compulsivity, that's when you look at it not as we got to deal with the item that the person's talking about, but my honey is bleeding, is basically what you see.
Yeah. See it as a red flag, because whether they're going into a more detached, addictive mode where they themselves are becoming caught up in addictive behaviors, or they're becoming compulsively over-focused on your behaviors, then it's a red flag that something underneath is hurting. We call that a mode, a position that they've shifted to because there's some vulnerability that's lurking beneath the surface.
And therefore the approach is, what approach would you use if you saw that they were compulsively being wrapped up in something and they couldn't get out of it? What do you do?
It could be something as simple as, even if it's a partner, the counterpart might just say, honey, I see this pattern over and over again. It's happening again right now. I'm wondering what might be going on that's upsetting you. Is there something going on that's upsetting you? Because we seem to end up in this type of a dance whenever there's something else happening behind the scenes. Can we talk about it? So it's even just bringing it to the forefront of the conversation rather than just engaging in the content. It's really talking about what's happening in the process of the relationship.
And what about the detachment, the emotional detachment that so often goes along with it? How do you deal with that as well? When the person just can't feel.
Yeah.
And they look at you and you're looking at them and you're trying to beg them to have a feeling come out of them and it's just not there. How do you deal with that?
I see it as the vehicle for expressing the feeling is blocked. I think narcissists do have feelings. And I think that, when I interview them about their feelings for a partner, for example, I might say, "Do you love her?" They'll say, "Yes." "Can you feel that love for her?" "Yes." "Did you want to hurt her when you said what you just said to her?" "No, of course not." Do you want her to feel safe? Yes. What if you just said all of those things to her? What if you could just express those feelings for her out loud? For many of them, it's just incredibly awkward, and there's this taboo, which goes again back to the idea that, exposing that vulnerable side of myself means setting myself up to be harmed, to be disappointed, and really to feel devastated by the outcome of the others. And so they detach emotionally. It's not, I don't think it's that they don't have them. I mean, they can become very preoccupied with their own agenda, so they're not really, attentively aware of their emotions, but I think the emotions are there. It's bringing their attention to them, and I spend a good deal of time really teaching them how to pay attention, how to become more mindful of the cues in their body.
My guest, we're going to have you back because I think we have much more to do on this, if you don't mind, Wendy.
I would like that.
You know, I would like that, too. I think we've covered one piece, and I think the next part of this comes with, number one, recognizing the underbelly a little more in both people.
Mm.
Because codependency is part of, now becomes part of narcissism.
Surely.
You know, and we talk about that. Maybe we'll do that next week, if you have the time. In fact, that's a good idea. Why don't we do that next week? Can you be here next Wednesday?
I can see, sure.
Sure. Okay, because we have Jana with us who helped us arrange this. Next Wednesday, we're going to continue with this discussion of disarming the narcissist and dealing with it. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. If you want a copy of today's program, you go to thepositivemind.com and you will see thepositivemind.com and you will see where it says archives. Just go to the archives and you'll be able to pull up a show, radio show today. And if not, you can go to WBAI.org and see if they have it up there as well. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Back tomorrow at 1 p.m. with more fascinating stuff.
Buscando el camino, de la libertad, la identidad, como el cauce busca el río. No lo puedo hallar, la realidad.
Proud of the tune in to hear a special presentation of Winter Soldier Iraq and Afghanistan, Wednesday, Thursday, April 16th and 17th, 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. Veterans from across the country testified about their experiences, giving an accurate account of what is really happening day in and day out on the ground, Wednesday and Thursday, April 16th and 17th. Contained within this special, Democracy Now! Will broadcast regularly at 9 a.m. and the WBAI Evening News, FSRN, from 6 to 7 p.m. On Thursday the 17th, a special within a special featuring perspectives from 2 to 3 p.m. Again, WBAI will broadcast Winter Soldier Iraq and Afghanistan on Wednesday, Thursday, April 16th and 17th over WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
On Tuesday, May 6th, at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, WBAI hosts a profound as well as hilarious exploration of the economy with acclaimed economist and New York Times political columnist Paul Krugman and comedian and social political oracle Reno, the rebel without a pause. Tickets for the 7 p.m. performance are $25, but for $50, you can also attend a meet-and-greet cocktail party at 6. Purchase tickets by phone at 800-838-3006 or online at WBAI.org. Do it soon. We predict a landmark evening on which Krugman deciphers the American economic precipice after Reno dives off.
Friday, April 18th, you're invited to join the Liquid Sound Lounge in celebrating 15 years on WBAI. And it will be Jeannie Hopper in the mix all night, along with live saxophone and flute by Jay Rodriguez. And this is all happening at the BAM Cafe, 30 Lafayette Avenue in the Fort Greene section of Brooklyn. And you can take the 2345 B, D, N, R, or Q train to Atlantic Avenue. The party starts at 8 p.m. and it goes on to 2 a.m., so make sure you get there early to reserve your spot on the dance floor. Everyone is welcome and it's free to all. For more info, go to liquidsoundlounge.com. Experience once again why ain't no party like a Liquid Sound Lounge party.
And once again, you are tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org. Coming up next at 2 p.m. will be a light show with Vic the Bruiser. And at 3 p.m., talk back with Hugh Hamilton. Do you have access to the Internet? Can you go online right now? All right, well, do me a favor. Take a moment. If you're listening to your radio, of course, take a moment and go on www.wbai.org. Can you do that? Oh, you've already done that. Show off. Fine. Well, you'll see our website, WBAI's homepage. You can check out.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.